welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 247 of the podcast. And it is the 12th of December, 2015, as I record this. And I was just in a shop and the Christmas music was playing. Oh dear, Slade. I mean, they just must get money every year for that song. Anyway, today I have an interview with Russell Blake, who writes thrillers and YA. He's one of the most prolific and successful indie authors out there with over 40 indie books. He also co-writes with Clive Cussler, so he is in that traditional space as well. We discuss what it takes to make a living with your writing, how to be prolific and stay healthy as a writer with that amount of workload, the pros and cons of co-writing with such a big name as Clive Cussler, and much more. And I am a fangirl of Russell Blake. He writes in one of his series, Jet, has a strong female protagonist, which is kind of what I like to write and read as well. So yeah, I am a fangirl. You will hear that in my voice. In publishing news, TechCrunch just reported that Flipkart has closed in India and given their customers over to Kobo. Now, this is really interesting, and I have this is as reported on TechCrunch. This is not yet on Kobo's media page, and I'm waiting for a kind of official statement from Kobo Writing Life, who are our sponsors today as well. But this is really interesting to me because right now Amazon is the only other significant player in the ebook market in India. There are 125 million English speakers in India, double the population of the UK, and they are the educated middle class Indians, the ones with disposable income who like reading. Now, when I was in Bangalore, it was actually 2 years ago now, I saw a lot of younger people on smartphones, you know, in the cafes and things. And so although print is still the dominant form of book consumption in India, I think this will change just as much as it will change in other countries over time and be more mobile focused. So I really hope that Kobo will be able to, you know, claw a market share in India. The more, you know, I think it's really important to have challenges in the various markets. Another interesting development, Amazon launched the Fire HD 8 Reader's Edition this week. Now, I have a Paperwhite and I love the Paperwhite because I like having a device purely for reading, and I read that in bed and it's got the e-ink and it's all marvellous. But the Fire HD 8 obviously is a tablet. Now, I realise I'm in the minority because sales of purely reading devices have gone down. But what's interesting with the Kindle Fire is that it's also now available in China. And the press release on that mentioned that it will give access to Kindle books with English language learning features like Wordwise, which is where you can click and then see what the meaning is. Now, that's pretty awesome. Now, just looking at the press release, millions of Kindle e-readers have already been sold in China, and the demand for the Fire is set to match those sales. So interestingly, in China, the iPhone is the number one mobile device. So we've got, you know, will reading go to the mobile, will reading on the tablet? You know, it's really fascinating. And then, of course, we only hear the reports from the US company press releases, and there are plenty of Chinese companies. So I'm really interested to, if anyone is in China, listening in China or goes there on business or pleasure or whatever, I'd love to hear what people think about the e-reading you know, possibilities in China. So please, you can always email me, tweet me, send me any interesting information. All fascinating in terms of global growth. Right, so what else? On writing, I just wrote a mega post this week. It's like 3,500 words or something. It's really big, on how to write a nonfiction book. Step-by-step process for writing nonfiction, because I've recently I did that co-writing book, and I'm writing another book at the moment on successful self-publishing, which I'll mention again in a minute. And that post. I'll link to it in the show notes. So if you are thinking of writing nonfiction, or you're writing nonfiction and you want some tips on making your process more streamlined, then check that out. It went up on the blog on 11th of December 2015, but I'll put a link in the show notes. That is How to Write a Nonfiction Book. Hope that is useful. And I might even use that as to do a whole podcast episode at some point, because I think we should all write nonfiction. Like, if you're a fiction writer, consider writing nonfiction. It gives you a different income stream, one that is generally more stable than fiction. Like, it, you know, you might get lower sales, but or higher sales, but they're more kind of ongoing as opposed to spike related to the seasons. And everybody generally knows something that is useful for other people. So so that's How to Write a Nonfiction Book. I've also just been reading Dean Wesley Smith's book, Stages of a Fiction Writer, this week, which is very, very interesting reading. And as he says in the beginning of the book, it might make some people really angry. So when you read it, you're like, oh, goodness me, you know, I recognise that. So I've been doing a lot of craft courses this year, including some of Dean Wesley Smith and Christine Catherine Rush's online courses. I consider both of them to be my mentors. I've never met them, obviously. They're my online mentors. I read all their stuff. I do all their courses. You know, they're both in their 60s. They've been in the publishing business 40 years. They've written 500 books between them. They know what they are talking about. So I recommend that book if you're interested in where you are as a fiction writer and where you are going. It's nice to know what the journey looks like and sort of write a list of the things that I can focus on to push my craft in 2016. I'm really, you know, looking to develop that more. Like, I know how to write a book and I know how to publish a book and market a book. What now is important for me is becoming a better writer. And that never stops. Like, what is so brilliant about being a writer is we can learn until the day we die, which is awesome because I'm a learning junkie. Okay. Oh, another thing. See, I've got quite a lot, long introduction this week, but I'm always encouraged by the number of emails I get that say you all enjoy the introduction. So I'm just going to carry on. And of course, if you don't, you can just fast forward. I've now started a now page on my fiction site, jfpen.com/now. That's, you know, N-O-H. And this is there's a sort of movement. There's a guy called Derek Sivers, who's a really great blogger. And he started a site called nownownow.com, where there's lots of different blogs or pages where people are logging what they're doing right now. So I'm committing to every Friday updating my now page with what I've been doing that week, what I'm thinking about, and pictures and things, just to keep me, you know, because I find this weekly show keeps me accountable to you guys for my kind of non-fiction side, and that now page is going to keep me accountable on the fiction side, to always be you know, and also just a kind of more of a log of what's going on, because I look back at 7 years of the Creative Pen, which started in December the 8th 2008. So yeah, 7 year anniversary. And of course, how much has changed in that time? It's just crazy. Really is crazy to think how much has changed. So I want to do that on, I don't want to blog so much, and I'm not doing a podcast for JF Pen, but I want to have that now page, and I'll be able to look back and see what I was thinking and what I was doing at that point. I've also, so the next book, Destroyer of Worlds, I am I'm still thinking about it. I do think about things, you know, a lot of writing is thinking, and I'm thinking about it. But we've booked to go to Prague after Christmas for a few days. I'm really looking forward to going to Sedlec, which is the bone church that features in my book, Crypt of Bone. Very excited about that. The bone church with millions of plague dead. Yes, I'm a little bit scary sometimes, but I'm very excited about that. And Prague, I've been to Prague before. It's an amazing place. And I have some ideas as to how Prague might fit into Destroyer of Worlds, which is mainly focused on India. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. And so pictures and stuff from that in the new year. Also makes me think, you know, I'm just giving you loads of book recommendations today, but the Prague makes me think of the Lainey Taylor series, Daughter of Smoke and Bone, which is fantastic if you like some YA fantasy. Really good. And of course, if you need some more Christmas reading, I have a very exciting announcement. Good Writer launches this week. It's kind of the book bub for author books, products and services, so courses and books. And they have an amazing sign up bonus if you go and join their email list before the 20th of December 2015. So take action on this show. I'll put a link in the show notes, but if you go to thecreativepen.com/goodwriter, and they are quite funny boys. So Good Writer is GoodWriter. So thecreativepen.com/goodwriter without the W, GoodWriter, to sign up before 20th of December, and you'll get my book, How to Make a Living with Your Writing, for free, along with 49 other books and courses for authors, including Writing Habit Mastery by Steve Scott, Gotta Read It, Libby Hawker, Structuring Your Novel by K.M. Wyland, Monica Lionel's Dictate Your Book, as well as other things on productivity, Book Launch by Chandler Bolt, and a ton of books by guests who have actually been on this show. All of those for free if you join the email list. Go to thecreativepen.com/goodwriter to sign up before 20th of December to get that bundle. And of course, you can sign up there anytime. If you use my affiliate link, then they'll know I sent you. In personal news, more personal news, since I'm just breaking it up today. As I mentioned, I'm working on a successful self-publishing ebook and also a multimedia course that will go through how to self-publish in ebook, print and audio, as well as marketing fiction and nonfiction. So my Creative Freedom course is really for established authors and those who want to take it to the next level. But I've had quite a lot of emails that say, you know, from people who are just getting started, either wanting to self-publish or maybe with a book or two, but no real sales as yet. So I know I am guilty of kind of running ahead and sharing the future of what it will be like. But if you're just getting started, the successful self-publishing book and multimedia course hopefully will be more useful for you. So that actually should be available next week, and I'm going to have a promotion code especially for my audience. So keep an ear out for that. Okay, so here's what you've sent me this week. Megan Scott Molin says, I'm listening while doing barn chores, can't wait until you visit Colorado, and sent a beautiful picture of horses at sunrise. That's lovely. And I'll be in Denver, Colorado in October for the Digital Commerce Summit where I'm speaking, which is cool. Lindsay Barocca, who's actually on the show next week, hiking with the dogs in sunny Arizona while listening to Dan Wood on the show. Picture of a running dog on the trail and looks like a red setter, I think, although I'm more of a cat person, so I may have got that completely wrong. Shannon Kelly heading off to work in the dark, but the commute will be a great one listening to the show. Fantastic. Marie Madigan, today I'm ignoring the chores and listening to the podcast in the pub, and sent a picture of Magners, a pint of Magners. Very nice. Kate Harrison, a picture from The Twilight Zone, listening to the podcast, walking the dog, shadowy writer's rule, and sent a picture of this almost sunset in the countryside. And Kate was referring to last week when I talked about the shadow industry that indies are in. Christopher Schumate or Schumate? I want to say Schumate. Listening to The Creative Pen and Dan Wood, then get an email from Drafter Digital and sent me a picture of his phone inbox, which was fun. Kitty Murray, listening to the podcast for the first time ever last night, and it was enormously helpful. So Kitty, I hope you're back for this week's show. Kerry Redgate, found you recently on Writer Files, raced out to buy a notebook just for your podcasts, scribbling notes while listening. I hope you're scribbling today, Kerry. Oh, Kate M. Colby made my week by saying, finally reading The Creative Pen's thriller fiction. Stone of Fire is like reading the Tomb Raider games. I like it. That made my week because I do, you know, like the kind of Lara Croft sort of brand and image in my head. And that's what I have in my head when I'm writing, is sort of Lara Croft. So that's fun. I would love to have a game like Tomb Raider for Morgan Sierra someday. And then the picture book people, said, thanks for the show, listening from Maui, Hawaii. The best part about working for yourself is you can work from anywhere while listening to your favourite podcast as loud as you want. Brilliant. I would love to come to Hawaii. If anybody would like to get me a speaking gig in Hawaii, I would like to come. And you have some good volcanoes, which, and of course, if you've read Risen Gods, you'll know I'm a little bit volcano obsessed. So that's fun. Okay, so this podcast episode is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I will play a little message for them from them in a minute. But I also just got an email from Kobo Writing Life, and if you publish direct, you'll get these kind of emails. And they said this, for box sets, 2D covers have been found to not only convert better, but look better on site too. So I have just changed my box set covers on Kobo to the 2D versions, as in the flat covers rather than the 3D covers. And of course, they have to be 2D covers for Apple. So I normally get two lots designed. My question now is, should they be 2D for Amazon as well? Now, it might be worth a try. I mean, who knows? I'm really not sure whether the 3D or the 2D work. It's very hard to do, you can't really do a split test of covers, because you can't have the same book up twice with two different covers, that type of thing. But very, very interesting. If you have tried 2D and 3D on Amazon and have any results, I'd love to know those. As ever, you can tweet me at the Creative Pen with a double N, or email me joanna@thecreativepen.com. Okay, this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. And as ever, a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks especially to new patrons, Michael Bartoff and Erica Lindquist. And I really do appreciate your support on Patreon. It demonstrates that you enjoy the show and want it to continue. And you can support for even just $1 a show twice a month. So $2 a month, and less than a coffee a month, I think, for that. And you'll get the extra monthly Q&A audio, which I will be doing for December in the next week. You can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Okay, here's a word from Kobo.
Hi, this is Mark Lefebvre. I'm the director of self-publishing and author relations for Kobo, and we are very, very excited to be a sponsor of the Creative Pen podcast. Something I wanted to share with Creative Pen listeners is the fact that via Kobo Writing Life, you can set your book to free at any time for as long as you want. There's no exclusivity requests. I would advise authors, though, who are looking to set their book to free, to think about it as part of a strategy. What is your goal to set it for free? Are you looking for more readers? Are you trying to garner reviews? Or are you using this as a funnel to get people into your catalog? Come to KoboWritingLife.com, where we discuss such things, and check out the Kobo Writing Life podcast, which is also linkable from the blog. And now back to your host, Joanna Penn.
Today I'm here with Russell Blake. Hi, Russell.
Hi, Joanna. How are you?
I'm good. It's so lovely to have you on the show. Just a little introduction, if anybody doesn't know you. Russell is the New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of over 40 books and has been featured in the Wall Street Journal, the Times, and the Chicago Tribune. He's also co-written books with Clive Cussler and is regarded as one of the most prolific and successful indie fiction authors. So, Russell, just tell us a bit more.
I think I should probably just leave right after that. How do you follow that with anything impressive?
I was going to say you've probably written to more than 40 books since I wrote that introduction, because you are so prolific.
Well, yeah, I think I'm on number 46, 47. You stop counting after a certain point.
Yeah, I imagine. But just start off by telling us a bit more about you and where you are in the world, because that's exciting, and a bit of a potted writing background.
Okay. I live in Mexico, in Baja, Mexico, and I've lived here for 12, 13 years now. I come from a entrepreneurial business background. And I had been writing probably for on and off just to amuse myself for the last 15, 20 years, but I never really submitted anything or considered trying to go the trad route. And then I became an indie published author in June of 2011, and I've never looked back.
Definitely. Is Baja where all the whales are? Is that the right place?
Well, you know, we like to call it, well, yes. They do pass by, and I'm not just talking about the cruise ships, but they come by every year, and it's spectacular. There's probably about 3 months where it's lousy with whales.
Well, that's just amazing. It's one of those places I'd really like to go. So I think of you there. And of course, you always mention tequila in your bios. What part does tequila play in your life?
Well, I would say that yeah, from around 10 o'clock in the morning to about 3 in the morning, it plays a very important role. Either I hate it or I love it, depending on what time it is. No, tequila is like the national drink of Mexico, and I've, you know, when in Rome.
Yeah, well, I must say, if I get to choose, I say that. I mean, I am a tequila drinker, so whenever I read that about you, I'm like, one day I'll just have to come over and have one.
They make about 200 different brands of tequila.
Yeah.
So. You can get into a lot of trouble just tasting them.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm interested then, as someone, you know, you write 6 to 10 books a year, I think. If you could maybe talk about how your writing process works right now.
Sure. Well, I started off as a pantser, I guess, where I did nothing except sit down with an idea and then just mush forward and see what developed. But as I've been doing this more and more, I've become really a pretty copious outliner. So I don't have to really think about where the story's going or whether I've got sufficient twists or beats, because the way I outline, I'm able to sort of visually see whether I've got sufficient movement, reversals, beats, all of the good stuff for a story. So now I'm pretty much 100% outliner. And I start writing generally at around 8 to 9 in the morning and keep going with a few breaks till about 10 to 11 at night when I'm in a novel.
Wow. Okay. So the outlining process, do you just do that like on a Word document, or do you use Scrivener, or are there any specific tools you use for outlining?
Well, I just do it in Excel.
Okay.
I create a spreadsheet, and I have across the top generally a list of characters, you know, so that I remember their names and who they are. And then across the left side, running down, I'll list the chapters, and I tend to put 1 to 3 sentence descriptions of the chapters, so I know what the motivation of the chapter is. I know what's going to happen in terms of the story. I know, you know, whether I want it to end with a cliffhanger or whether there's an action beat or there's a reversal. So, and I color code them so that at a glance I can look at the entire manuscript when I'm sort of done with the outline and visually confirm that there's sufficient action, sufficient reversals, sufficient beats of each type.
Mm.
I mean, it's a little anal, but it works for me.
Yeah, well, it's funny because, I mean, I'm way behind you. I think I'm on number 11. You know, I am still counting. And it's funny, exactly as you say, you become kind of more and more into outlining. I certainly see every book I'm doing more and more outlining. So it's interesting that you're at that point. So when you were back at book 11, were you doing that kind of outlining, or were you still pantsing back then?
Well, I was doing single chapter summaries. I would just have a Word document, and I would jot down the first 10 or 15 chapters that I thought needed to happen, and then I just trusted myself to be able to do the next 15 once I got it to about chapter 14 and a half. So it was a quasi-pantsing, quasi-outlining. But I've just discovered that the more I force myself to think through the story, and especially the structure of the story in advance, the better the story winds up being, and the faster I can write it.
Yeah, and how long does that outline take you to create before you start the actual writing?
2 to 3 days.
Okay, in that sort of 10-hour-a-day slot as well, or do you
I actually slack off when I'm outlining. I maybe I sort of do it maybe 4 hours a day because, you know, the cognitive process, you know, when you're cogitating over what's going to happen with a story, a lot of times, you know, you want to go for a walk on the beach or whatever it is you do to sort of get yourself in the zone where you get a breakthrough idea, because otherwise it's just going to be hopelessly formulaic. So I don't push myself in terms of the number of hours when I'm outlining. That's simply a writing thing.
Yeah, and I'm glad you said that because I think that you're right. It's often when you're out walking or doing something else that you get those ideas. And then you actually start the writing. And are you still at a walking desk?
Yes. Yeah. I have a treadmill desk. I've had it for, 2.5, 3 years now? And almost 3 years, I guess. And it has been a lifesaver. I recommend it to everyone. I've lost, I want to say, 25 pounds since I got it. And, I'm certainly a lot healthier because that's one of the things most people don't discuss. But being an author, especially if you clock the kind of hours I do, means that you're sedentary and that kills you.
Yeah, and it's cool. I'm looking at, I'm still trying to get into dictation, you know, walking and dictating. Is that something that you've tried at all, or are you good on the treadmill desk?
I'm good on the treadmill desk. It took me about 2 days to get used to it, but I don't walk fast. I mean, I walk maybe 2 miles per hour. So if I'm actually walking for 3 hours a day, I'll clock 6 miles, and that's wonderful. And then I stand up most of the rest of the time. I haven't tried the dictation thing simply because of the way my brain works. I mean, I'm very visual, and it's important for me to see how the words appear on the page, how they flow.
Yeah.
And that's important when I look at the musicality of the verse and just the pauses. I can't do it speaking.
Yeah, well, that is my mindset at the moment, and I'm like, I've got to stop sitting down. I think that's the thing. I have a standing desk now, but I think the stamina. I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, the stamina in the hours you work. Do you think it's purely the fact that you walk that you cope with that, or do you have other ways of coping with working that many hours?
Well, yeah, no, it's the dope and the booze that really, you know, see me through. Like, what are you kidding? You know, a little bit of coffee, but mostly it's just the excitement of getting to the next chapter. You know, I tend to be very, you know, I set myself up so that if I'm going to, you know, if I'm going to clock, say, between 6,000 and 8,000 words a day, I think of that, you know, I mean, that seems daunting, but if you think of it as, okay, 4 chapters, well, that's not so bad. And now you're thinking only of those 4 chapters. And if you're eager to get to the next chapter as a writer, you're probably going to be eager as a reader. Because there's nothing worse than being in the middle of a chapter as a reader and going, I don't really care. I just have no impetus to turn the page. So I find that if I'm not eager to turn the page, so to speak, as a writer, it's very difficult to fake that for the reader.
Yeah, well,
My stamina is driven by a combination of desperation and greed, I guess.
Yeah. We'll come back to that. Okay. But on genre, I mean, you write. I've read some of your Jet books, and I mean, you write action adventure, conspiracy thriller, mystery under Russell Blake, and you also write YA new adult under R.E. Blake, which are all genre fiction. Do you talk about being pulled through the book and, you know, getting excited to do it? Does that only happen for writers of that kind of genre fiction, do you think? I mean, because literary writers, I think, tend to write more slowly because they're not pulled through the book.
Right. Well, sure. When I read something, you know, literary fiction, you know, there's not a lot happening. There's a lot of introspection. There's a lot of beautiful use of language, flow, musicality, but not really a lot of, oh my God, I need to turn the next page to get to the next 19-line sentence. I mean, it's a different experience. It's work. You know, reading literary fiction is work, and it requires that you as a reader do work. You need to have developed your reading appreciation and skill level to a certain point to appreciate it. So I think writing it, you're more cognizant that your reader is likely to be parsing every single syllable. Whereas in genre fiction, you know, sure, you aspire to some sort of musicality to your prose, if you're any good, I think. But the reality is it's more about the characters and the story. So it's more about keeping the plot moving. It's entertainment. Whereas literary fiction, while it can be entertaining, I find it to be more sort of high art. And I don't mean that in a negative sense, like it's the opera of reading, but in a way it is.
Yeah, I agree with you. And do you think that an indie author can be financially successful writing anything other than genre fiction?
If they can, I haven't seen it. I mean, I hate to say that, but the way that Amazon works, it's really set up to be more along the lines of the Walmart to the world. And I'm not that sure that aficionados of literary fiction go to Walmart for their choices. So I think that's one thing that TradPub does well is they tend to distribute they've got the entire chain and the entire prizes and literary merit, et cetera, that they've cultivated and curated for a century. So they really are very good at directing product to the 60 or 70,000 people that really care about it. Whereas on Amazon, it's more of a fast food sort of approach rather than a gourmet restaurant. And there's nothing wrong with fast food. You can make a lot of money in fast food. It's just not, it's not a 3-star Michelin restaurant. At least that's what I've seen.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. And of course, you write some great blog posts, occasional blog posts, but very good ones when you do. And you do talk about the quality is highly subjective point of view. So, in terms of writing fast can't equal quality. So what are your thoughts on quality and the indie world and sort of authors changing their mindset around that?
Well, I think that you have to be mission specific about your writing if you're going to do this with an expectation to earn a living at it. And given the market conditions, it's sort of like the ride at the fair, where you have to be at least this tall in order to get on the ride. And then being taller than that doesn't necessarily help you any. So I think that, as genre fiction authors, you have to develop a sense for whatever genre you're working in, because the expectations vary from genre to genre. If you're writing, Navy SEAL billionaire stepbrother shifter stuff, you probably are going to have a different quality level expectation from your consumer than if your book is sitting next to James Lee Burke. So you have to understand your genre, and you have to write well enough to satisfy the reader in that genre. And that's why I say it's subjective, because, authors always get into those arguments about, oh, 50 Shades was terrible, and this newly popular book is awful, and blah, 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 blah. But what they fail to recognize is that it's popular because it satisfies a popular desire for whatever the product was. So as writers, you need to understand what your genre is, and you have to understand the conventions and the norms, and you have to write at least as well as, say, the top 10% in that genre. Now, I aspire to do better than that, but, that's just a personal thing. If I'm going to do something, especially something I enjoy, I'm going to try to get better every time I do it. Otherwise, why keep doing it? With 45 or 50 books out, it's not like there's a surfeit of Russell, a dearth of Russell Blake books available for consumers to buy. So I try to raise the bar with every offering.
Yeah.
But is it necessary to do that on a personal level? Probably. It depends on the genre.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I look at the action adventure conspiracy thriller niche, which you're in, and I also write in to a point. And that is actually very much full of big name traditional publishing authors and mostly men.
Oh, yeah.
And did you go after that genre or did you, I mean, I said I before we started recording that I read one of your earlier books, which was more in a supernatural kind of, you know, thriller that I write in. But did you go after a subgenre that was dominated by traditional authors on purpose, or did you kind of go in at an angle?
I actually wasn't that thoughtful about it, and I probably should have been. On reflection, what I did was I just wrote what I enjoy reading when I read fiction, because most men read nonfiction, and I know that's a generalization, but you know, especially as they get older, they tend to, if they have a job, they tend to, when they are going to read, they tend, at least all my friends, you know, tend to read nonfiction. So when I read fiction, I'm doing it as escapism. And the escapism, you know, for men's fiction tends to be the adventure, conspiracy, thriller type of genre. So I just wrote what I'm accustomed to. And, I knew the conventions because I've read 1,000 books in that genre. So I didn't have to do a lot of research to identify what makes for a good one or a bad one. What's funny, though, is that as I've written more books in the genre, I've become much more analytical about how I'm achieving whatever I'm trying to achieve within the book. And I notice it's impossible not to deconstruct other people's work to see exactly what they're doing structurally. So I find myself doing that a lot more. But I think that if you read in the genre, you do that automatically. It's by osmosis.
Yeah, definitely. And your kind of standards go up. And I read in the same genre as you, and I write in it because I love it too. So, you know, I'm glad you said that. And of course, I grew up reading Dirk Pitt, and I met Clive Cussler this year. So sure. I was so super excited that you now co-write with Cussler. So what are the pros and cons of being alongside such a big name?
Well, I mean, the pro is obviously that you learn a lot. I mean, he's forgotten more about, writing action adventure than I'll ever know. So, you know, being exposed to that level of expectation and level of inventiveness and quality, the man's, I want to say, 84, 85 years old now. So if you can still, you know, work up a decent plot at that age, hats off to you. I mean, seriously. So he brings 45 years of writing in the genre to the table. So that's a tremendous learning experience. It's like going to school and church at the same time. So that's the positive. The negative is that readers of authors like Clive tend to only read their favorite, Clive, and maybe a couple of other big names. So you don't see the kind of audience following you over to your backlist or to your own work that you would hope. So that was a kind of a shocker for me, because that was the entire idea in the first place of pursuing working with a big name traditionally published author, was, if he's got 5 million people to buy his book, I co-write it with him. That gives me exposure to 5 million people. Well, that's not how the math really works, because when they buy a Clive Cussler book, or, you know, a Robert Ludlum book, or a Tom Clancy book, they only really see that name. They don't really see yours, even if it's on the cover. It's incidental. So, I mean, that's just the reality of it. So, yeah. You know, there's pros and there's cons.
Yeah, it's so interesting you say that. I've talked to 3 people now who've co-written with bigger names, and they've all said the same thing. Like, it was a surprise, because there wasn't the kind of carryover that you might expect. Right. But as you said, I mean, you also learned a lot, and it was, you know, super interesting. So would you do it again, or are you doing it again?
That's a difficult question. I think that I would be reluctant to do it again, simply because there's only so many hours in the day. And if you're not going to see the audience carry over to your own work, it really just becomes it's a paycheck. Ask yourself, do you need the paycheck? Or would it be more satisfying on an emotional level, creative level, and a financial level to simply generate more of your own content? Yeah. So that's not a question I can answer for anybody else. For me right now, where I'm at, you know, there's only a few people I would probably be interested in co-authoring with, because I've been there, done that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. But of course, on the other side, you have Jet in Kindle Worlds. And Kindle Worlds is only open to Americans at the moment. So that's something I haven't been able to do as a British author. But
you should talk to me. I've got some ways around that.
Yeah, I know some there are. But I'm interested in your view of the other way then, because, you know, in the Kindle Worlds view, you are the owner of that world. And people, even though people aren't co-writing with you, they're still writing in your world. So have you seen fans of Jet go through into the Jet Kindle Worlds books?
Oh, absolutely. That's who buys them.
Right. So people do cross over, even if the author name is different, because the character
they,
is different.
They do because they're buying the world. They're not buying the author at that point. In other words, they like Jet, they like explosions and you know, a female protagonist and, you know, a certain level of prose, et cetera, and in between me releasing Jet books, they want to read other that's what they like consuming. They like the world. So I think it really affords the authors that work within the world an opportunity to get exposure to readers who wouldn't otherwise see them. And I originally did a Kindle Worlds. I wrote in Steve Conkley's world. That's how I got into the whole thing. I wrote a novella for his Perseid Collapse world, and I had a blast doing it. I mean, it was fun because I didn't have to invent a backstory. I didn't have to invent characters in a world. I could use his and plug, you know, some of my own creations into it, and it practically wrote itself. So you know, that part of it was enjoyable. But I think when you write with, you know, if you write with Dan Brown, you know, if it says Dan Brown on the cover and then your name is in, you know, 3 millimeter high letters, yeah, you know, the chances are pretty good that nobody's going to go, God, I need to go buy that guy's books. I mean, that's just how it works. I would that it were different.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's just how it works.
No,
on the fan fiction, I think, you know, you're appealing to a different readership.
For one thing,
you're appealing to people who like a world and are willing, you know, they're probably buying books in the $4 to $6 range. They didn't pay $22 for your hardcover.
Yeah, okay, that's going back on my list. Fantastic.
Yeah, no, you should. I would recommend doing it. I wouldn't invest, you know, I wouldn't spend 6 months writing a novella, for one. But I think it's worth doing for an author that whose world is a good fit with yours.
Fantastic. Now, you also, I mean, you wrote again in one of your wonderful blog posts, quote, your odds of being successful are lousy, better than traditional publishing, but still terrible. So what did you mean by that?
You're going to hold that against
me. What can listeners do to improve their odds as an indie author?
Well, I mean, I think you have to go into this understanding, you know, that the arts and creating entertainment is the arts. Content generation of any sort, whether it's music, whether it's dance, whether it's singing, your odds are beyond terrible. And that's just always been the case. I mean, you know, 10,000 little girls go to ballet school, but all 10,000 of them are not going to be professional dancers. It's not going to happen. So, you know, there's a culling process, and maybe two of those will wind up being paid in, you know, to perform 10 years after they start practicing and learn their craft. So I think you have to view writing exactly the same way. It's an art form. You wouldn't pick up the cello and expect to be Yo-Yo Ma after your third cello lesson. You wouldn't expect to be dancing Swan Lake after your third ballet class. And you would recognize, you know, it's like everybody's played, or most of my friends have played in a garage band when they were teenagers. You know, everybody enjoys playing in a garage band, but nobody kids themselves that they're going to be the next Rolling Stones. And if they do, they get disabused of that notion pretty quickly. You know, the odds have always been terrible in the arts of making a living at it. So once you just get that through your head, it's very freeing, because now you understand that, you know, the odds are what the odds are. You don't have unreasonable expectations, but you can start looking at how to narrow, improve those odds for yourself. And the way, you know, the way I recommend to any new author, or even anybody putting out their 15th book that hasn't experience the kind of success they hope for, is keep upping your game on craft, because, you know, the readers that are going to follow you from book to book are not the ones that bought it because it was on sale and are always looking. They're not coupon clippers necessarily. The people that are going to make a living for you are people who feel that they can't get what you produce from anybody else.
Mm.
So you have to figure out how you're going to be the exception, how you're going to be unique in terms of your voice, in terms of your story, in terms of your word choice, your craftsmanship. Then you know, by extension, your cover, you know, what does it convey? What level of professionalism? Can it sit next to a traditionally published author's book on Amazon and look the same? Or does it look like you did it in Microsoft Paint on a 3-day drunk? There's just presenting a professional product that appears to be worth paying for is a big part of it. And then tuning your blurb so that it can stand next to a professionally generated blurb, your product description.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things buy you just a little bit of edge. A little edge here, a little edge there. You know, they see the cover. Okay, that looks interesting. They read the blurb. Okay, maybe. So then they go to the look inside, and that's where the pedal hits the metal. If you don't have them within the first couple of pages, they probably aren't going to buy the book. So that's where your craft comes in. And also, if you pick a genre, or even better, a subgenre that's large enough to support you, you're probably going to do better than if the answer to, well, who would give a shit about your book, is everybody. Well, no, not everybody. Not everybody cares. So if you're writing, say, military sci-fi, you're probably going to have much higher odds of finding a readership, because it's a very specific niche. Whereas if you're just like, oh, it's a book for the ages, well, okay, but there's a lot of those. So I think that you know, if I was starting all over again, I would advise myself, write in a series, pick a subgenre of men's fiction, because that's what I enjoy reading, and you know, publish regularly. And then when you publish, make sure that the packaging and the product looks professional.
Mm. And you write, I mean, many of your books are shorter, aren't they?
Shorter than what?
Well, as in, I mean, I know some people think that a book has to be sort of 80,000 words, but a lot of your...
No, that's what my books are. They're between 80 and 100,000 words.
Oh, okay. I thought some of the Jet ones were more novellas.
No. The Jet ones are all like, you know, my minimum word count on a Jet book is 79 to 82,000 words.
Well, there we
they
go.
They just read fast.
Yeah, they do. They read really fast.
And that's good. I mean, if you can put 80, look, when you, if you can do 80,000 words and it feels like it was 40, you did something right. If you put 80,000 words and at about 60,000 you're groaning, that's not a good thing.
No, you're right. They are really, really fast. And you know how to hit a return key, as the lovely Dean Wesley Smith talks about, the pacing. it's really fast.
Well, yeah, and I'm getting, you know, this latest one I'm working on, really, this is a third in the Ramsey's books that I'm right now, I'm at about 25,000 words on it. I spent longer outlining this book and worrying about plot and pacing than any book so far. I've got to say, it's paid off.
Mm. No, that's fantastic. And I wanted to ask you, like, when was the tipping point in terms of when you knew, this is the right thing and I'm going to make this financially, well, you know, as well as anything else?
Well, you know, it was a disaster for the first 7 months. I was, you know, I was just shotgunning stuff out there, you know, learning my painful lessons. I put out 10 or 11 books in my first 7 months, across, you know, all across the board in terms of genre. I mean, you know, the first one, Fatal Exchange, was really a crime mystery, I guess, you know, and then the second one, the Geronimo Breach, was a conspiracy action thriller. And then, you know, I tried a bunch of different things, all very loosely in men's fiction, but realistically hopped all over the place. And I didn't start to see any traction until I started writing my first series, because mm-hmm. those were all standalones. And unfortunately, this market doesn't reward standalones the same way that it rewards series. So once I got that through my head, because I'm stubborn and I was like, oh no, I'm not going to be contained and limited by, you know, writing a series that's so formulaic and predictable. Once I got past that and kind of went, yeah, but your customers are sort of saying they want series. So give the monkey what it wants. Don't fight with it. So I started doing that, and then things took off. And yeah. I was also timing-wise, you know, I hit with in the golden years of KDP Select. So because I had generated enough content, I was able to run a free day about every 10 days on a new book for a solid 4 months. And that happened to be the 4 months where each time you ran a free, you would expect to see 7,000 to 10,000 sales after.
Mm.
So I was able to do that for, I want to say, a dozen books, whereas the average person, you know, had one or two. So that was a huge leg up. Got me a lot more exposure.
Yeah, so it's still, I mean, you know, still is, you know, write in a series and have a lot of books. You know, it's not rocket science.
No,
you know, it's still
nothing in life is.
Yeah. Just being
nothing
consistent.
In life is. And, you know, I have friends that write in the movie industry and in TV. And I have friends who have been professional musicians and made good livings at it. And they all say the same thing. They all work their asses off. They work long hours. And they all say it's not rocket science.
Yeah, and longevity. And, you know, it's amazing how many people fall away, isn't it? You know,
well, because they don't have expectations that match reality. I think there's a lot of magical thinking in this business. And because I come from a business background, I tend to ask myself different questions, and I tend to view the business differently. I view it as two separate and distinctly different disciplines, one of which is content generation, mm-hmm. and that's the writing. And then the other is packaging and selling. And that's the publishing business. And they're very different. They're distinctly different skill sets. So you kind of have to sign up to being good at both. And typically the type of personality that enjoys content creation doesn't really have the skill set nor enjoy the publishing part of it. So, you know, it's difficult. I think most of the people I've seen that have fallen by the wayside that had a fairly strong start and couldn't keep it up did so because they just couldn't get a handle on the publishing part, not the content generation.
Mm. Yeah, all those people who went kind of back to traditional publishing because they just didn't enjoy
it. Well, tried to. Mm. They tried to. It's not like it's easy to get picked up by traditional publishing either.
No,
I mean, that's getting harder and harder. The royalties are down. The advances are, you know, have never been lower. So it's, you know, I'm very happy being an indie. Let me put it that way. Knowing everything I know, unless you're going to have a lottery win on the trad side, you're better off being an indie, in my opinion.
Mm. And you've obviously now you've talked with Clive Cussler and you've sort of hobnobbed with big name traditionally published authors. Do you see a shift in their attitudes towards indie books and indie authors, I suppose?
Well, I don't, you know, I'm always surprised by the sort of polarized invective that you know, you hear, you know, from the trad versus indie. Clive, you know, didn't have a problem. He didn't care whether I was indie or not. He cared whether or not I could write.
Mm.
So he evaluated the work based on the quality of the work. He wasn't really interested whose imprint was, whether it was my own or whether it was Random House. It didn't matter. And I think that there's probably two groups of you know, and one of my has become somewhat of a friend, an internet friend, is Lawrence Block. I think the older guys who are in the business who don't have a dog in the hunt, so to speak, they don't care. It's just you're just one of them. You're another schmuck trying to, you know, make a living, you know, telling stories. So, and then there's this other, you know, the whole, you know, Amazon is the devil, you know, that group. I don't understand that group. I really don't. It's like, yeah, I understand you've got your position of privilege and you've been awarded this, you know, the imprimatur of quality by being curated by supposed experts. But at the end of the day, it's you writing and readers reading. So I'm not sure I understand why everyone's so angry at one group or the other.
No, I agree with you. It's interesting when I go to Thriller Fest every year, and I agree with you. I mean, I've talked to Doug Preston, you know, and who was of one of those groups, and yet in person he's charming and nobody says anything negative at all. Everyone, in fact, wants to know about things.
I think a lot of that is manufactured. A lot of it is manufactured because the traditional publishers, you know, have a agenda that they're trying to advance, and Amazon has an agenda it's trying to advance. So both of them will use the media however they can to get across their perspective. And the authors, meanwhile, are creating content every day and trying to find readers.
Yeah, exactly. And I also, back on your blog again, you have another good quote. If you're successful, you've bought yourself a job. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I think anybody that's done this quote unquote successfully vocationally understands that. There's no, you know, unless you have a lottery win, and, you know, there I can think of a few people who have. Hugh Howey is my favorite example. He's a very talented writer, and he acknowledges right up front that, you know, he doesn't know exactly why Wool went mega. And, you know, it's not like he did something particularly different. It just did. So unless you have that kind of success, you're only as good as your next book. And your readership will forget about you very quickly because there's so many other people making noise trying to get their attention. So this is a job. This is like writing for TV. You know, you're only as good as the next episode you're writing for. If your muse doesn't show up today, and you don't generate the required 10 pages so that somebody can film the show next week, you're out of a job. So this is, you know, it's a wonderful job, but at the end of the day, unless you're one of the, you know, top 50 authors in the world who have film deals and who are a household name, you're working. You bought yourself, it's exactly like if you're a business person, you go out and you buy a delicatessen or a restaurant. You're buying yourself a job. You're showing up every day, you know, making sure that the food is fresh, making sure that nobody is stealing anything. It's a job. And that's what content creation and publishing is. You're creating content, which is a job, and publishing is trying to sell content, and that's a job. It's a wonderful job, by the way. It's my favorite job ever.
Yes, and I agree with you. I think it is wonderful, and I love all parts of it as well. But it is hard work, as you say. I mean, I work harder now than I did as a business consultant. You know,
me too.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, me too. This is the most hours I've ever clocked doing anything whatsoever, and I've done a lot of different things. And this is by far the hardest, but it's also the most rewarding, just on a sort of holistic level. I've done things that have made me a lot more money, but they weren't, you know, I wasn't looking forward to waking up every day to do it again.
Yeah, and I was writing about this the other night just to myself in my diary, going, you know, what is the most fun thing? And it's finishing that book and going, I made this, you know, and I just made another one. I mean, do you still get that with each of your books so many?
Of course. Yeah, otherwise, yeah, why write it? I mean, I went through a period where I was kind of like just dreading the act of writing. because it had become like a job, you know, and that's why I had to kind of, you know, talk myself through that and go, well, what did you think it was? What is your expectation in this? Do you think that every day is going to be a day where you're clocking a 10? Because no other job or career do you clock a 10 every day.
Yeah.
So why are you expecting that here? There's going to be days where you have to push yourself to get through the work, and it's a job.
Mm. And many people would say, you know, you're at the top. You know, you've got this great success. You've been, you know, on all the lists.
I don't think that many. I need more people to say that. That's what I need. And then buy all my books.
Well, even Lee Child says that. You know, he's like, well, most people have never heard of Lee Child. And it's like, that's all true. But what is your ambition now? I mean, do you consider yourself ambitious? And do you have a 10-year plan as such?
Well, I think it's silly to have a 10-year plan because so much changes, you know, from year to year. I've been doing this for 4.5 years and the marketplace is completely different. And Amazon can flip a switch tomorrow and decide that none of my books get seen or none of an indie's books get seen or that, you know, they really do think 35% is the right royalty instead of 70. So much can change. The only thing that I don't have ambition to become a household name because I'm sort of at an age where I don't require that.
Mm.
You know, it's I don't require the entire world to think that I'm a unique voice and talent. I'm not kidding myself that I am, you know, Steinbeck. I am producing genre fiction and I aspire to be able to make a better than average living doing so for as long as I want to do it and as long as readers are willing to purchase my work. Anything beyond that is icing on the cake.
Yeah.
If a movie deal comes, if somebody, you know, says we must hand you 7 figures for your next work, whatever happens, that's all great, but I have no expectation of it. I think it's very important to be, you know, I mean, there's that old cliche that the work is its own reward, etc. But after a certain point, once you have the car you want and you live the place you want, you know, whatever it is in your life that you need in order to feel like you are complete and have done what you want, the work really is the reward.
Mm.
So it's one of those cliches that's a cliche because it's true.
Yeah, and it has to be because you can't guarantee the success.
Well, no, you're likely not to succeed. So you might as well write something you personally are proud of and like.
Yeah, exactly. Right, last question before I let you go. What do you see coming in 2016 in the indie world? Do you think it's global translation? What is your pick?
Boy, I don't know. I'm going to try to write fewer books next year, which my editor is probably listening to this. It's going to be, you know, she's like, I did a screen save of that. So I'm going to try to only write 5 to 6 books next year. I've been selling my translation rights. You know, I've been very fortunate that publishers in other countries have bought Jet and have bought the Ramsey series and translated them. Audio, you know, they kind of kicked the chair out from under audio when they changed the royalty scheme. So I'm not that excited about audio anymore. I invested, I want to say, at least $50,000 in narrators and doing 25 or 30 books in audio. But the ROI, the return on investment on those, has shifted from where you expected to get your money back in a year to where now if you can make it back in 2 years, you're lucky. And that's 2 years is a lifetime in this business.
Mm.
So that stopped being as attractive. I think it's going to be a tough time. I think it's going to get tougher. And I think that you're going to have to paddle harder to make the same money. But nobody's holding a gun to your head either. So if you don't like it, go get a day job.
Okay, well, it's been fantastic to talk to you, Russell. So where can people find you and your books online?
Well, wherever fine ebooks are sold, you can read my thoughts such as they are at russellblake.com. I'm on Facebook, just search for Russell Blake. I'm on Twitter, although very, very rarely these days. And all of my books are available through Amazon, and about 85% of them are available on iTunes and Kobo and Barnes & Noble and Wide.
All the rest. Well, thanks again, Russell. That was great.
Yeah, no, it was a real pleasure.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.